Hi, I'm David Pogue. Welcome to the RV Navigator Podcast, your digital home for the RVing lifestyle. Visit the RV Navigator homepage at rvnavigator.com for additional information about each episode. And now, here are your hosts, Ken and Martha, podcasting from their mobile studio that might be parked in a campground near you.
Hello, this is Ken, your RV Navigator.
And Martha, the co-pilot.
And it's been 63 days of Alaska adventure, and it is over.
Already.
We have made it back to Dawson Creek. We make a circle, and you drive first the Alaska Highway one way west, and then you tour in Alaska all you want, and then you get on the Alaska Highway and head east back to Dawson Creek. And then it's on to home, which is a whole nother story.
And we have been keeping an eye on the weather because fall colors have come out in prominence. And the Alaskans always talk about the termination dust. And when you see that, you better get out of here.
Termination dust
is a light dusting of snow up on the mountains.
And this campground that we're staying in Dawson Creek actually closes at the end of September. So we better get on the move because other campgrounds along the way will probably close about the same time. And this is far north, and we have to head far south, down to Chicago.
Lots more driving.
But it was quite an adventure, and we are we hit a little problem.
Speaking of driving.
Overall, the roads didn't cause the caravan people much of a problem.
Really
we had
not.
One flat tire, which I'm not sure was caused by the road. We had a couple of other minor issues.
Somebody had trouble with their electricity.
Yes.
Kevin, who you've met, had chips in his windows before he even got to Alaska, so we can't blame that on Alaska.
Any road you can get a chip on. But the RV Navigators.
Oh, we were driving along, climbing a hill.
In Alaska.
And it went...
No, I remember about pop.
And I said to Ken, did the car come off?
Ooh, that would be an ultimate.
And luckily the car was still there, but we no longer had much power to finish climbing.
I didn't really notice what the problem was right away because the engine was running and it just went pop, which we both heard. And if you have a diesel pusher, you know that it has to be pretty loud for you to hear the engine
from
the
back.
And we were kind of climbing a hill, and all of a sudden, I just ran out of power. Very strange. The engine, I didn't have any distress lights on the dash. I didn't have any other sounds that we had problems. So we were rather perplexed. We pulled into a rest stop.
In the middle of nowhere.
Fortunately, because we were with a caravan, a couple of others pulled over with us.
To commiserate, but none of them knew what to do or how to fix it it even was about.
Yeah, and the engine ran and sounded fine, and there were no dashboard lights or any sort of warning. So I said, it must be just an anomaly. But when we got back in and started to go, and I floored it out, as I have to accelerate, there was just no acceleration.
So we took the car off because it's a lot of stuff for the engine to pull.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And I followed the RV Navigator up and down the hills in the car very slowly.
So I could get it up to 40, 45 miles an hour, but going up the hills was very slow. But it made it, and we made it to the next campground. And
which was nowhere.
Which was, literally in the middle of nowhere. And nobody there to fix it. We called CoachNet. And by the way, if you travel to a distant location in the boondocks, you probably need to have some sort of roadside service and make sure that it's a good one. And CoachNet is a good one. And they would have towed us the 100 miles back to...
Semi-civilization in Whitehorse.
In Whitehorse.
In the Yukon.
Oh, the distances are just unbelievable. But I determined that I could drive it back to Whitehorse, the 100 miles back to Whitehorse without the car, and we would find a repair facility there.
That of course, this happened on a Friday night.
Oh, yes.
So nobody could help us till Monday, no matter what we did.
So we did drive it back to Whitehorse, and that worked out well. The rest of the group had to go on because, of course, they're not going to wait around for us. So they went down to Skagway, which is famous for its huge hill, which is okay going down, but coming back up again, we never
would have made it.
And so we went Monday morning. We got up early at a recommended repair facility. Coachnet helped us with that, and several other people recommended this particular repair facility. So we were there right at 8 o'clock in the morning when they opened the doors. It's something you just never would have expected happened.
We're there explaining to the manager what happened and that we need help, and a man comes by in his professional overalls saying to that manager, "I have nothing to do. Please give me something
today
to do."
Yes.
And
one of
we
the mechanics.
Said, "Here we are."
Can you believe that happened? So, this very competent mechanic, well, we didn't have our RV because we didn't know what kind of a schedule they would have, but
we
rushed
had no
back
appointment.
Home. Buttoned up the RV and slowly drove it the 3 kilometers back to the repair facility, pulled into their garage, and the guy gets to work. And
even from what we told him of the symptoms, he already knew what was wrong.
Yes.
Which gave me great confidence. But he was right that he knew what was wrong.
And one of the feed tubes to the turbo had come off.
Because There was a clamp.
Well, he didn't know exactly what the problem
was.
That
had fallen off.
But I wouldn't even have recognized that there was a problem. But he opened up the engine. And, of course, the problem with diesel pushers is the fact that the engine is really pretty much enclosed in the back. We don't have a radiator all the way in the back. We have a side radiator, which is a help when you're doing just general maintenance. But even so, the engine is hidden underneath the back. And so he says, oh.
That's why people don't like to work on RVs.
That's true. And if you have a Super C or one of those, 18-wheeler type of front ends, that, you know, the hood opens up and everything, the engine is all right there. And he could have fixed our problem in about 5 minutes if we had had that kind of engine compartment.
So he took the wooden cover off the...
Oh, did you know you can get into the
engine?
Yeah,
because I've seen that
from
before.
The...
Yeah.
You did.
On Jeff's, I think. Underneath
one of the
our
ways
closet,
that you get in the back of the motorhome
is a cover, a wooden cover,
yes.
Very decorative and not too
very,
hard to get
well,
off.
It's but, carpeted and
but he
looks just like
but
the
he
normal.
Pokes his nose in there and he says, "Oh, I see what the problem is. See that blue ring there? That's where the clamp should be. It fell off."
So there was a hose that was very dark in color, as it would be after 13 or 15 years of use. And there was a bright blue ring around it where the clamp had been. And this is the clamp that held the air intake to the engine from the turbo. Oh, that's the other thing I recognize is that the turbo was not turboing when we were driving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the turbo usually runs between 20 and 30 PSI. The turbo was not pressurizing.
You had very low numbers.
Very low numbers. I never realized how important the turbo was.
We do now.
In most engines, I guess, I always thought the turbo was kind of a extra accessory that made it perform better, but wasn't really essential. But I couldn't get the torque gauge above 40% without the turbo being connected. Anyway, so he diagnoses it and then says, "I can't reach that guy from here, from the bedroom." And so he goes outside, and it's like against the wall of the engine compartment, closest to the passengers. And he says, "Boy, I don't know how to get at this." But finally he decides that he's going to take off the tag wheel and undo the shroud, the fender-ish stuff that's underneath that, and that's how he finally got up in there and fixed it.
10-minute job, took 3 hours.
Right. $15 clamp, which had apparently fallen off for some reason or been destroyed, so I don't know what happened to it. Fortunately,
know.
It didn't get ingested by the engine someplace.
Yeah, that would have been bad.
And he charged us 4 hours of labor. So the total price was $658.
Canadian,
which which was a benefit, of course, but still $658, $15 of which was for...
The clamp.
And if it had been just a Super C or a regular diesel engine with a cab in the front, then it would have been, he just would have slapped the clamp on there in 10 or 15 minutes and charged us half an hour's worth of labor. So, ladies and gentlemen, that is a story, but it is kind of a nice that we were able to get it fixed quickly. It was done by noon. We were able to rejoin the group
and finish the caravan with them.
I still didn't trust it enough to drive all the way to Skagway and then trike that hill back.
Luckily,
you know,
we'd been there before, so we knew what we were missing.
Yeah, Skagway is one of those cities where if you've been on a cruise, you know what Skagway is like, and you've been there a dozen times, and we have driven down there a couple times.
Beautiful.
Beautiful city and great visiting.
So we did some sightseeing in the Whitehorse area until it was time for us to catch up with them again.
Right, and so we drove on and caught up with them in the end of the caravan here in Dawson City on time.
And we should add that we were not the only ones who had to drop out of the caravan. Our reason was mechanical, but one couple stayed behind for a few days because their cat needed to see a vet. And another couple stayed behind for a couple of days because she had a medical issue and needed to wait for medication and see somebody and get that taken care of. So even when you're on a caravan in Alaska, remote as it seems, there is help there and you can get it.
And the caravan folks help you find these
figure
places
out
and
how best to handle
how best
it.
To handle it. Although, of course, the expense is on you.
Yeah.
So, with that said, that's our story. But we want to talk about the story for the others on the trip too. And you know that we started this trip 2 months ago with an interview as we were about to depart on the caravan. We had Jennifer and Kevin, as well as Doug and Sally, who we sat and chatted with, and we're going to do that again at the end of the trip and get their impressions. And of course, this is to help you decide whether Alaska is on your list of places to visit. They are novice travelers to Alaska. We are experienced travelers to Alaska, but everybody has their own perspective. We want them to share with you what their ideas and how they did on this trip.
And Jennifer and Kevin very much jumped in with both feet, booking almost every excursion that was available to them. And Doug and Sally took the opposite approach and did a lot on their own. So you get kind of the yin and yang of how you can approach a caravan such as this.
So here is the interview with the six of us. Sorry, we only have three microphones, so everybody has to share a microphone with their spouse.
We can do that.
Okay, take it away. Well, dear listener, we are here in Dawson Creek once again, and it has been 2 months since we last gathered this crew together to talk about the RV caravanning trip. And we are here again with our RV Navigator listeners, Doug and Sally and Jennifer and Kevin, who were here on the first day over 63 days ago. And we are here to give you our impressions and to share with you ideas about your trip to Alaska. So go ahead, start off, Doug.
I don't know.
We made it.
We made it. It's hard to believe it's been 63 days. It just flew by when you saw the weeks going by. It's like, how can we be moving this fast? But it was a fantastic trip. We would highly recommend it. Alaska in general, and this tour in particular with the Alaska Excursion Caravan. Uh-huh. And just no buyer's remorse, none of them, but just we had the greatest time. I'm sorry to see it come to an end.
Ditto. I would agree that it was very well organized. We had driver's meetings at the every night before the next day's drive. Every heads up for the road conditions and everything else you'd need to know. Very well taken care of by Cindy and Jim. So very, I would highly recommend it.
So you had a little bit different philosophy on this trip than we did. We kind of bundled all of the excursions together as part of the trip, but your philosophy was a bit different than that.
Yeah, we planned for the certain big ones that excursions uh-huh. that we wanted to do, like side-by-sides out to a glacier mm-hmm. and a flight up to Denali and that kind of stuff. But then we wanted to keep our options looser for the rest of it, so we didn't overbook a lot of tours. And then judging by the weather and how we felt and what other things that we wanted to do, then we would kind of book stuff along the way. And a couple of those were through the excursion people, uh-huh. who that's one of the concierge services they uh-huh. offer, is booking our tours through their preferred operators. But we also went off-grid a little bit, went and did a couple of our own tours, too, with other operators that we saw just at the last minute, uh-huh. thought, hey, let's go do that.
And that worked out?
Yeah, worked out perfectly. No, and Homer, I'd enjoyed, we went by on a boat to an island where there's tons of birds and puffins, and so the next day I arranged for a boat to take me out uh-huh. there for an hour to take more photos. And then we took a helicopter up onto the glaciers in Skagway uh-huh. that wasn't an official part of the
Which
tour.
Which we just stumbled
But
upon.
we only knew we were doing it a half hour before. We said, do you got any openings? They said, yes. We said, we're on.
Okay, so that is an option in Alaska to kind of really do it on the last minute.
Yeah. I think it's presumed that when booked through Alaska uh-huh. Excursion Caravan, you're on their tour, that you would book your excursions through them, because this is part of how they
And they provide excellent service.
Yes, and they provide
all the way
service.
Through. I mean,
so we only those two, I believe, uh-huh. were nothing that she had offered anyway. So
yeah. Okay. So you guys, Kevin,
we both agree that it's unbelievable how fast. Yeah. These 2 months have gone by.
Then we're back here at the same campground 2 months later, and you've done so much.
And I remember at the start thinking, wow, boy, 2 months is a long trip, but it didn't seem long at all. And, most places we stopped, it would have been nice to be there longer.
Uh-huh. That's an interesting comment. How is the pace of this trip?
I think it was fine, because the downside is staying at the same place for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
As you may, even with 2 months, you may limit your opportunity to go and see other places. But we, unlike Doug and Sally, we pretty much booked all our stuff, with mm-hmm. the exception of one excursion with the tour operator. And I can remember when we were signing up, just going, man, these are some high dollar excursions, but I got to say, every one of them worth it. If you're going to be using air support to get to these remote places as part of your activity, they're going to be pricey, and they were great. I don't regret a single one of them.
And that says a lot for Kevin, because he is kind of frugal.
So spending $1,000 on an excursion didn't bother him?
More than $1,000. He's right. These are difficult places to reach. They're unique experiences. It's just unbelievable to be, as close to bears and other wildlife and on the glacier and everything else. And, that costs money, but boy, I don't think either one of us has had any buyer's remorse, to quote Doug there.
And if you're going all the way to Alaska, you don't want to come back saying, I wish I had done more, because it's a long way to go.
Go big or go home.
And I think that's the thing we found out is that the getting to Alaska is a major event in your life. We spent 9 days just getting to here. And then the first part of the trip is taxing, because you're driving. It's on the Alaska Highway, 1,400 miles. We've now driven that both ways, and that takes a long time. So I guess one of the things that I would make a strong suggestion is plan to spend enough time in Alaska to make it worth that drive. And I think you guys would definitely agree.
Absolutely.
With that. How about the season? Now, there's a spring and a fall trip, or a spring and a summer trip, I guess. Anybody?
I would say I repeatedly throughout this trip was so grateful that we were on the fall trip.
Really?
I mean, I've never done the spring trip, so I don't really have a comparison, but I just thought that the fall colors and everything, uh-huh. I mean, Denali was just breathtakingly beautiful.
Yes.
It looked like a painting everywhere you went, and it was because of the season, and it was just fantastic. And we got pretty good weather. We had a few rain out days, but it was wonderful. I think with the spring, you get more baby wildlife and stuff like that. But I think it's a good trade-off to get the beautiful colors and things.
I put this question to Cindy, and she said the spring trip was best.
Because
this has been our experience, and I would agree with you. Having the Northern Lights available to us
I'm so happy we took the summer tour too, because they call it summer, but really into fall, especially in Alaska. The leaves started changing more than a month ago.
Yeah,
because like Jennifer's saying, the fall colors are just gorgeous, just beautiful. It just really brings out that nice contrast. And then even the wildlife, the moose, the caribou, they've got a full rack of antlers. They're out there looking for love, maybe a little bit more visible. And I think just everything about the, and I looked at some pictures from the earlier trip, and like a lot of the lakes were still ice choked, especially coming up through Banff or Jasper if you wanted to do a side trip before they got there. I just think a lot of the trails still had snow on them and stuff, and I really like this time of year.
Yeah, I would agree. To me, this was fabulous. And she said the weather's better in the spring, but I don't know. I think we've had pretty good weather.
We had great weather.
And they seemed pretty darn rainy when they got into camp.
Oh, here. They got into here.
Yeah, well, they were covered with mud. So, yeah,
but
I find interesting is on our drive back now the last 4 days, we're kind of reversing the season and seeing less turn colors, so it's kind of like we get a whole new start to fall as we head south
and east. Yeah,
we'll be like a perpetual 4 week peak of autumn going south. You know, to just keep moving with it.
Yeah, I don't know whether the full daylight is good or bad. I mean, we're now seeing a decent sunset, which are nice to photograph. But in the spring, I think you just see 24-hour a day light.
And you hit on the fact that the aurora is visible now. I mean, I guess it may be visible in the spring, but you have to stay up until 3 in the morning.
No, she doesn't make any claims to that.
But we saw unbelievable northern lights on this trip. I mean, to the point where I was like, okay, northern lights. You know, I mean, when you get blasé about northern lights, you know, they were very accessible to us and just gorgeous. That alone is worth this trip, I think.
All right. Though, if you're doing this by yourself, if you're doing your own trip, you would have the advantage of leaving in May and coming back in September and doing both trips. So is that worth the trade-off of having them? They have to do two trips because of the economics of it, I assume. So our trip started on July 20th and ending here on September 20th, whereas the other one starts in May and ends in July. So if I was coming by myself, I would say, hey, I'm going to do them both. There's no reason why I have to make a choice. Is that worth it?
I think I'd come up a little bit earlier in the season if I was doing it on my own, and I would still book a few campgrounds, but I think I'd boondock more, too, now that I've seen the lay of the land and kind of have a better idea of the geography of the place. I'd feel a lot more comfortable trying to boondock and come along. And that's not just always just to save money on a campground or something.
No,
it's just because you're passing all these great places as you're driving down the road.
So
you see all these places, like right by this lake or this river. It's like, I could boondock there if I didn't have to keep up with this caravan to get to the campground. So I think that would be a big advantage of doing it.
Does that outweigh the benefits of the group living?
Well, I think the caravan was a great introduction to Alaska and seeing it, and I would absolutely do that again for a first-time visitor. If I was to come back again, I think we'd do it on our own or with a small group.
So we did it the other way around?
Like that. Yeah, so because now I feel like I could easily do it on my own. I've seen it. I've done the reconnaissance, and now I can go ahead.
Yes, but the challenge of booking all the campgrounds, I don't see it specifically Doug doing all that. So.
But we tried to look around in the campgrounds where we were, and very few of them were chock-a-block full. And from our past experience, you could call a day or two ahead of time and make a reservation, so you'd have somewhere to be. So I don't know if you need to do all that planning while you're still... I mean, we started talking about this last December, and it's hard to even imagine being here when you're so far ahead and making reservations. So it's not as jammed tight as people think.
Well, and that's the thing I want to kind of get across, too.
And the campgrounds, while adequate, were generally nothing special.
Exactly.
So you're not missing out.
No. Well, and I think the caravan has to provide full service, or as best they can get for full service, for everybody all the time. So they have no choice. But some of the campgrounds we have been in have been, you'd never stay in them in the lower 48 unless you were just passing.
I would consider it more like a boondocking experience on some of
those. Or a parking lot connected to a hotel. I would never do that otherwise.
Right. But they have to provide those hookups. But my sense is just like you, Doug, I would love to have stopped. And we did. We did several nights of boondocking on our previous trip. You know, so people are so afraid of coming to Alaska, other than the long distance driving, but is the camping really different?
I wouldn't say so.
Making reservations and making the travel plans. Once we were there, it struck me that the distances were reasonable. That's what we would drive on a day. I mean, we would drive maybe 200 miles on every 3 or 4 days, and that's it.
And it's a different kind of camping trip because it's almost like being on a cruise or something. The RV is just a vessel to get you from campground to campground so you can jump off and do your day trips and your excursions, that kind of stuff. This isn't really what I would consider a true camping experience where you're pulling into a site and you're putting out all your lawn chairs and
sitting
rugs
down for
and
a
everything
week.
And a grill. You don't do that kind of stuff. This is just stop in, plug in. Rest up for the next day, get ready for whatever's going on. Maybe in some days we'd arrive at the campground, you'd have to go do an excursion of some kind. So this is all about the activities and the other things outside the campground. The campground is just a place to plug in.
Yeah, mm-hmm. too much here. Never used the recliners once. Pulled them out once just because I hadn't used them and put them back away without having used them. So
yeah, we haven't grilled. Yeah, you're right, because we've been... Yeah. We've been frankly busy.
Yeah.
I grilled a few times, and there are some times we had like a group fire, campfire outside. So there was a few times, but not as much as I thought there would be. I thought we'd like almost have a campfire every night or something. But
on our previous caravans to other destinations, that has been the case. It's been much more social. Every night was a social hour with drinks and stuff, and it was much more common that we would have that social experience.
I think some people had social hour drinks and stuff.
Yeah, well.
I've been parked next to them. But I have to say that a highlight for me was the people on the trip. I love meeting new people and from different walks of life and stuff. And, you know, if you read the news these days, you get the idea, or social media, you get the idea that America is on the verge of civil war and we're all tribal and everything. I'm sure there are people from all stripes on this trip, and they were lovely. Everybody got along great. It was just a very collegial, very family kind of feeling, I felt. I love that because it just really added to the trip for me.
Great group.
No, there's almost no political talk or any of that kind of stuff, and no one was decked out in political paraphernalia, t-shirts and hats or bumper stickers all over the thing. It was just nice to be, that's kind of not what I
set
expected
that aside.
To be. I thought there'd be a couple of people.
There's a little religious stuff.
Yeah.
But so we have two Class A's and a fifth wheel. What do you need to come to Alaska?
Spare parts, maybe?
you definitely need a second vehicle. You need a towed. There's a couple people in our group. One was a truck camper, and one was like a Class B, Class C kind of a thing, and they weren't towing anything, of course. And they had a lot of difficulty, I think, sometimes getting out and going and doing stuff where they couldn't hitch a ride with somebody, or they'd have to disconnect
That's
all their
point.
Stuff and go drive their big, you know, 22-foot, 24-foot RV around as their driving vehicle. Or the rented car. I know they rented a car at a couple of places, and I just think, boy, if someone asks you my advice on coming to Alaska, I say you absolutely have to be mobile. You just can't park in the campground and say, okay, we're done for the day.
And your big truck was not an issue?
No, it worked great, much better than I thought.
Did you need four-wheel drive?
There was a few times I put in the four-wheel drive, on some of the back dirt roads and stuff that were able to tape. I went on a lot of roads and a lot more roads in my big four-wheel drive truck than I would have with our towed that we used to use with when we had our Class A. Uh-huh. I wouldn't take that van on a lot of the roads that we were able to do in the truck.
So on this trip, we had four Class A's out of 14. We had a couple of smaller B types, 23, 24 feet. We had a truck camper.
Two travel trailers.
Three fifth wheels.
Fairly large fifth wheels, I would say. And then yours is kind of moderate size. Yours is 24.
Ours is 30.
30.
But you don't find too many fifth wheels that are smaller than that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the small size fifth wheel.
So the bottom line is, I think, in looking in the campgrounds, that we saw virtually every type of RV. So whatever you're comfortable in, you can bring it to Alaska.
And you don't have to go out and buy something special just because you're coming here.
You know, and that's another thing. Somebody here bought their trailer. One of the trailers was bought specifically to come to Alaska because they didn't want to bring their Class A. And I find that, I think the Class A is one of the best vehicles to drive here. It's a truck, goes over the roads, you know, and it has all the truck components, and it is designed for the kinds of roads. But how did you find the roads? Did you guys?
Oh, how did? Oh, you mean how did we find the conditions of
yes.
the road? Okay, yeah, I found the roads on a map, but I found the conditions of the roads to be pretty much about what I expected.
Uh-huh.
There are some definite rough spots and some frost heaves and all that, but that wasn't unexpected to anybody that's been doing any research about this.
Perhaps it was to our advantage to come at the end of the summer when many of the roads were already repaired.
Yes.
I think it might have been worse if we'd come earlier.
Yeah.
Like we were in Valdez, every time you went left the campground to go out and do something, more and more of the road is paved. There was less and less dirt just in the week that we were there in Valdez. But I found the roads to be pretty good. You learn to read. You learn that some problem spots are marked with flags or cones, but you can also just kind of read the road
by looking at the center line or the side.
Yeah, I can't say we were surprised too often by any big bumps or anything like that.
But I think that's a skill you definitely developed as this went on.
Yes.
You know, you really
yes.
saw what kind of indications were worth paying attention to.
Pulling into the oncoming lane to avoid...
Yeah, using the whole road.
I use the whole road.
Yeah,
no,
absolutely.
No question about it.
So to me, the worst roads were on the Alaska Highway getting there and back.
In the Yukon,
on the Alaska Highway. But once we got to Alaska, I found the roads to be pretty much as we would find them at home. You're right, there were some frost heaves. And for those of you who don't know what a frost heave is, the pavement looks okay, but it waves. It dips and comes up again. And the reason why that is because the asphalt melts the permafrost underneath the layment for the pavement. And so it sinks. And so unexpectedly, you'll have this dip that... can be a real killer.
Think of it as being in your favorite amusement park.
And we talked to a local who said that they had done a study about one of the roads, and they had found that over the years they have put down over 30 feet deep of asphalt to overcome the dip. So that every year they put down another layer and then another layer, and then now it's over 30 feet. So, but bottom line, roads are fine in Alaska. I got an email yesterday about somebody who says, I just don't want to come because the roads are just not what I can expect. And that's not true.
But when you were talking about whether Class A is a wise choice
uh-huh.
over any other vehicle, I think there's risk to every vehicle.
Sure.
We've had breakdowns of Class A's in our group.
Sure.
Breakdowns of everything breaks. So
well, yeah.
The risk of a Class A is it's going to be harder to find repair
uh-huh.
For a particular, you know, a chassis issue or something.
Yeah.
It's a remote Alaska. But if you're a truck pulling a trailer, you might be better off if your truck breaks down because a lot of places can fix your truck. So the people who brought the trailer maybe... That was
that's hard to say. I think Alaskans are very resourceful and not the specific stuff like slides and other Oasis things that are in our motorhomes, but I think the chassis can be fixed. The motors, the diesels and the chassis, you know, suspension parts and those tires and all that sort of stuff can be easily fixed. And Alaskans are used to that.
Some of the remote places we were in.
Well,
I wouldn't want to.
Well, and that's another issue. How about fuel?
Fuel I didn't worry too much about. If it was convenient, I'd try to stop at the cheapest station. Otherwise, I didn't
care. How far do you get between
tanks? I overpaid quite a couple places for fuel, like in Haines and a couple other places where I just didn't care. I'm not going to get all worked up over $5 or $10 extra at the pump or something. It's just not worth it. So when we're spending so much money anyway, so I just filled up when I need it and whatever it costs.
Well, and that's the question. Could you fill up when you need it?
Oh, yes. I never came anywhere near running out of fuel.
So how far do you go between tanks?
I have a range of, when we're pooling, around 350 miles or so.
So that's not really that
like
much.
That. No, there's plenty. There's plenty of stations in any 350-mile stretch.
Uh-huh. And you found the same?
The same thing. And we, you know, we have about a 700-mile range, so there was never concern about would we make it. But you gotta think in advance,
yeah.
You know, and make sure you're being smart about knowing how far you're going to go and and what kind of options you'll have.
And one of the advantages of being on a caravan is that the wagon master tells you about the fuel ahead, tells you where it is, tells you which side of the road it's on, tells you if it's a good pump or it's not so clean. So I felt confidence when we did stop to fuel that we were in the best place we could be in at that point.
Yeah, I appreciated that. She waved you off of places with sketchy fuel, and same with restaurants. She would put a do not recommend next to something that was kind of sketchy, and you know, you wouldn't know that if you were on your own necessarily.
We all use DEF too, and these days diesel engines use diesel exhaust fluid. How about that?
You know, I have used one box of the DEF I've brought with me.
Because they recommended you bring three or four.
Yeah, so I have three in my tow just waiting, but there was sufficient DEF at pump that, you know, I...
So
I
even that was not...
Yeah, that was not... I mean, it was not common, but it was common enough to... Because, as you know, you don't need to put DEF in at every stop, so... eventually, between four or five stops, you know, you'd find DEF at a filling station.
It was expensive.
The DEF?
Yeah.
I don't know.
The boxes of DEF, I use boxes, and they were in the $16 range.
Yeah, and I don't have any point of reference because I've never used boxes until this trip. In our Class A before and now our truck, I've always filled up at the pump. So this is my first experience going from a box. And I brought a couple of boxes with me in the back of the truck to have as backup, but I didn't really need to use them. I've used them now both just to empty them and get rid of them so I don't take them all the way home.
Yeah.
But I really think I could have done most of the trip with maybe just one box the rest of the time I was able to find at the pump.
So we've dispelled most of the reasons why people don't want to come to Alaska. I think the roads.
Bugs.
Bugs.
I'm surprised. I never used bug spray the entire trip.
And
not once.
Not because you didn't need it. Because you didn't need it.
Yep.
Yeah. I barely used it, and I didn't receive a single mosquito bite this whole time.
I think I got a couple, but it wasn't. It wasn't
you
bad.
You didn't use the repellent.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, and she had us mix up this. Did you use the special mix-up repellent that she had?
The secret potion?
I don't necessarily subscribe to the oils and natural homeopathic bug spray regimen. So
I brought four cans of Deep Woods Off, and I'm going home with four cans of Deep Woods Off. That'll probably last me 20 years.
Because you hear about mosquitoes that are the size of a fly and, you know, all sorts of things.
How about scary animals like bears?
I know, I wasted my money on bear spray. I was hoping to have the chance to use it, and I'm going home with bear spray, too.
In fact, we have two expired cans from prior trips, and we have our new cans that'll probably expire in 5 years without ever having been discharged, but that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, I don't know whether you say...
I'm just joking, obviously.
Well,
I don't want to be in a bear's face. I don't have anything to do with the bears, not just for my safety, but for them. I try to give all the animals plenty of
We did have a moose wander into camp and visit one of our... campers.
In the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night, but that wasn't a dangerous situation, at least not obviously.
I think the bear spray works. None of us were attacked by a bear.
They were scared of the cans.
And we all had the bear spray, so that's a win.
But we didn't see many bears. You saw some nice ones at the...
Yeah, I saw some bears, but they weren't interested in us. They were interested in fish. You know, the bears are they're more interested in eating and do whatever they need to do to get ready for winter. And if you really think would have to provoke any bear up here to have an incident.
Get you close.
And what's interesting is any excursion you go on to go see bears that you're going to have to fly to, they're not going to let you bring your own bear spray on any float planes or helicopters because they don't want it discharged accidentally.
Well, in the air.
So it's really just when you're, you know, we always took with us when we were hiking on our own.
And did you do a lot of that? How was the hiking?
I mean,
you did some spectacular
ones. It was great. It was one of those things, though.
Was it a lifetime experience? I mean,
it was. It was.
Pinnacle.
I mean, we just couldn't believe how beautiful this place was and, you know, and just what you would see when you go up there. But it's kind of like between your outings and your excursions you signed up for, it'd kind of be nice to just come back to Alaska and hike, you know, just stay places and spend 2 weeks at Denali.
Absolutely.
Be out in be out on the trails. And
so this is kind of an introduction to Alaska. For us, it's kind of a culmination because we did things that we hadn't had the funds to do before. So So for you, though, it might be a good introduction.
It is, but, you know, it's that same old problem. Boy, we'd love to come back, but, boy, there's 50 other places we want to see and do, but I think this is a contender for a return trip. Despite the effort it takes to get here and get back, it's well worth it once you're here. I mean, it's...
But you got to spend the time. Okay, so one of the things they ask is, what was your favorite tour? What'd you put down?
Our favorite tour...
We had a few.
The helicopter onto the glacier in
that
Skagway.
That you did right in Skagway.
Or
and that was because of the weather.
Beautiful. We got there. It was a beautiful day. It was just spectacular day. And I'm not talking about just like clear blue skies. I'm talking about...
So tell us about the excursion. You left from Skagway.
We got there, drive around town. We unhooked the trailer.
The excursion.
Okay, so we helicopter, a 20-minute helicopter ride up to
20-minute
up onto a glacier. It's a real helicopter, not the little Robinsons. It was a Eurocopter. Six passengers. We flew up onto a glacier. They dropped us off, and then we were about 45 minutes on the glacier. There was rivers rolling down through
guided
it. There's big holes you could look down into as their guides there. When they land you, they fly off and go back for other people and take a group that's already there.
So it's quiet.
So you're there, you're kind of quiet.
Oh, really? That's
nice. The helicopters, you know, an hour late, 45 minutes later, they come back and you pile into the helicopter and fly back again, and they do a little bit of a sightseeing trip over the glacier. So, but that was just the one we took at Skagway. I know that everybody else in the group took similar tours other places.
So that was your number one.
I think so, or the side-by-side out to the Nick Glacier. That was good.
That's...
For us, I mean, it was really hard to narrow it down. Because
there were so
many
good ones.
10 number one excursions, and only one that we didn't care for. So, I mean, that's pretty good batting average. The two that popped to mind is in Haines, and this was like our first excursion. We got onto a 1957 Beaver plane. And
a single engine.
Yeah, and which was meticulously restored, and we flew over Glacier Bay National Park. And my mind was blown. Yeah, low and slow. And it was just incredible. And that was how we started off our trip. And it was a real, whoa, we're not in Kansas anymore moment. And then the other one that just really stands out was the walking with the bears, which sounds off-putting to many because of they perceive it to be dangerous. But I really didn't feel... like, we were in danger. We were with a guide who really knew what she was talking about, and she taught us how to crouch low and clump together to be non-threatening to the bears. And we were out there, like, just a few yards away from bears in the wild.
We were within 10 feet, I think, a couple times.
It was just the most fantastic wildlife viewing experience I could have ever even imagined.
Yeah.
So those were my favorites.
And both of those were expensive. I mean, we're talking thousands for each one, so... You know, you got to come with the idea that you're going to spend some money. I think that our number one tour was the side-by-side trip to Nick Glacier, which was the only tour that everybody did, which is very interesting. It came highly recommended, and it was very good. You know, we don't drive ATVs, but I tell you, these vehicles, we drove them through the water and through forest and mud. And last month, I have a picture on the webpage about it, but it was very exciting to do. And they took us to a Glacier Bay where there were icebergs floating around, and they cooked us lunch, and then we drove back, so it was...
And some people got to go swimming there, too.
Oh, that's right. We actually have pictures of people taking the polar plunge in water with icebergs, so you knew it had to be really cold. So, you know, we have done some really spectacular, and there are many more. But I think the thing that was interesting to me is that they were all curated in some way, that we were given recommendations and they were accurate. She said the side by side, which we would never have done.
I think
she said, you've got to do this.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And of course, I think taking a helicopter to a glacier is kind of pretty obvious, and flight seeing is another one that's pretty obvious, that, you know, those are things you would want to do. But there were some, like the dog kennel.
Jeff King.
Four-time Iditarod champion.
Wasn't that good?
That was excellent. That was that was way more interesting and better than I thought. Because, like, the day before, we'd already seen a dog sled demonstration at the National Park. A little sad thing with the ranger there, compared to what we got at the Iditarod. Now, of course, that was more, the national park was more about the dogs.
Yeah.
The other thing with Jeff King, that was more about the Iditarod as a whole race. I have a much better understanding of that whole thing and what it takes to win it and everything.
Very like polished.
Very, I feel like I watched a documentary on the Iditarod.
Right.
So I would say that the fact that this was so curated and, you know, there's no shortage of vendors up here in Alaska.
No.
I mean, that you can hire to do stuff. And I'm sure some of them are great and some of them are not so great. And the fact that she went through and, you know, really picked ones that were exceptional, makes it a lot more comfortable to spend the amount of money you got to spend.
One thing that worried me a lot is all these flights. You hear a lot about planes crashing in Alaska and the weather conditions, and the people she chose to fly us around were so qualified and professional, and if the weather was bad, we did not go. Mm-hmm. So I've never been on so many planes in 2 months in my life, but I never felt unsafe for a second.
I also appreciated the fact that we never had to stand in line for tickets, we never had to pay for tickets, and if the weather was bad, she just automatically rolled us over to a better time. I mean, all of that would take your time, and you might not have been able to do it because you didn't have the pull with the vendor, but when we did our helicopter, we waited for, she scheduled it, canceled it, scheduled it, canceled it, scheduled it, and we went, and it was like perfect weather. I mean, you can't guarantee that all the time.
Yeah. We had the same experience where we didn't even realize it was going to be bad weather. This was several days before, and she said, it's going to be bad weather when you do your helicopter flight to this secluded glacier lagoon.
Yeah.
And would you rather do this day instead? Because it's going to be bad when you go. And we're like, how can she tell that far in advance? And we said, well, okay. And we did it, and it was a beautiful sunny day. And in fact, the guide said it was like one of the top 5 days that he's ever seen there. And then sure enough, on the day that we were previously scheduled to do it, poured down rain all day. So I would have never caught that.
And that was a pre-sketch, so that was moving it forward.
Moving it forward. Yeah. I would have never caught that. Not only did she catch it, but she was obviously looking for things like that. You know, she spends a lot of time scouting ahead and trying to find out, okay, this is going to be good weather, this is going to be bad weather, and moving you around. And then same with the Northern Lights. You know, she tries her best to tell us.
Yeah.
Obviously, the lights don't always cooperate, but I appreciated the fact that she was just really committed to making sure that everybody had the best experience.
I would definitely second that. That was quite obvious. And one of the benefits of having a tour leader, as opposed to going by yourself. So, final thoughts.
Glad we did it.
And I'm very glad that all of you came with us, because I gave Ken a hard time about doing this long drive for the third time. And because you both agreed to come, that's why I'm here.
Ah.
Well, that's interesting.
It's been an absolute blast. And as a one thing we haven't touched on, as a pet owner,
That's a good point, too.
I will say, you know, while it's kind of annoying to get the required inspections, you know, twice for a course of the trip, it was not a problem at all. And
But the benefit of the trip is that you have somebody to watch your dog.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that aspect is great, because you go out on a long excursion, and it was nice to have part of your tour include.
Not just nice, it was, you had to have that.
Well, or a lot of cleaning materials, yes. It's doable with your pets, and the part of being in the caravan is to have a service like that really helps you get away on your own for extended periods.
But that did cost you extra, though.
Well, it only cost you extra, like when we went on a hike by ourselves.
Oh.
There was a fairly de minimis charge for the...
So that's one of the benefits of this tour is that it includes pet watching. Mm-hmm. And I would say half the people had pets.
Yeah.
Of the 14, about half had pets. Mm-hmm. And some people had, they had three dogs, the leaders. So they are obviously pet lovers. But that was a nice feature. How about prices? Well, fuel, I just paid $4.50 a gallon for diesel just yesterday.
I paid more than that. one of the problems of, you know, having a smaller range, you don't really have. You can't say, well, I can skip this fuel stop and go to the next one where it's cheaper. But like I said before, I just don't really get caught up too much in the cost of it. I don't want to think about it. But
people do ask. People do think about that.
Yeah.
You just
they do, but I don't even look. You know, I just know, okay, this is when to get fuel. Yeah. It'll fit my rig when I look at the service station.
If you want a place that you can drive into.
And, you know, it is what it is, and I'm just happy that...
In Alaska, the food was surprisingly expensive, both in the grocery store and in restaurants. And the other thing, I feel compelled to warn anybody who has T-Mobile...
Uh-huh.
That
no service.
Apparently T-Mobile does not believe Alaska is part of the United States because there's just like zero service. And so that was a little bit of a pain. But we had Starlink. I highly recommend Starlink if you come up here.
All three of us
and,
have that.
And that saved the day.
Yeah.
I thought the grocery prices were not as bad as I thought.
It'd really?
We were a couple small towns and there were some expensive prices if you had to get something. But I found the... I was expecting grocery prices to be much higher. Any restaurant kind of food you got, that was super expensive. Yes, very expensive. But I thought the groceries weren't that bad.
And we were surprised that the halibut and salmon prices were outrageous.
Yeah.
Local, what you consider to be local foods.
Fish and chips is like $40.
Yeah, I know.
Lunch plate was like
it was hard to find an entree in a restaurant for less than $40. U.S. So.
Yes.
Okay, we thank you very much for joining the RV Navigators, and we hope that we can maybe do it again sometime.
Thanks for inviting us on the trip.
Okay.
Glad we took advantage of it.
It's been great.
It's been nice talking to you. Well, we want to thank them very much for sharing all of their ideas about the RVing caravan to Alaska, and it's an exciting experience and one that you need to plan for, and hopefully you'll be coming to visit Alaska in the not-too-distant future.
And if you can find friends who are interested in travel the way you are, which these two couples certainly are our cup of tea, it makes the experience so much more fun. When we finally get home, people who are in our neighborhood will say, "Who on earth are you? We haven't seen you for months." And when you tell them where you've been and what you've been doing, they kind of get this look on their face like, "Why?" But obviously these couples knew why and really enhanced our experience in Alaska and made it a lot more fun. I hope when you get to go to Alaska, you get to go with nice people like them.
So upcoming, we are going to be traveling the 2,000 more miles all the way back to Chicago.
We hope feel
to
like be home. We're done, but we know we're really not at that.
Right, this is only halfway. Oh, it is so far away. We hope to be home by October 1st or so, and we will be reporting to you in full about the end of the trip on the next month, because we have another interview to go, and we have lots of interesting topics, I'm sure, that we'll find as we travel home.
We're really talking about RVing.
Yes, finally. And we hope not to have another story about the motorhome.
No repairs.
That would be a real blessing. But stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen, and we will give you the full report. So, it's possible we might see you in a campground near us in the next month.
Thanks for listening. Happy travels.